Hello and welcome. You're listening to Fourth Estate, the show where journalists talk journalism. Coming to you from 2SER in Sydney on Gadigal lands of the Eora Nation, right across Australia on the Community Radio Network, and directly to your device across the globe via podcast. My name is Peter Frey, and I'm, among other things, the co-director of the Centre for Media Transition at the University of Technology, Sydney. And my esteemed producer tonight is Anthony Dockrell. Coming up, trust me, we have a special edition of Fourth Estate as we explore the media and how we can build trust. The reason for this special looking at trust is because the Centre for Media Transition is about to release a new report called Trust and New News Media in Australia. But we're not here to talk about me, you'll be gratefully relieved to hear. We're here to talk about us. The Sender's report comes as a new survey reveals the extent of the trust crisis across all institutions, including all levels of government and most parts of the news media. It's a plague. Work by the Museum of Australian Democracy and the University of Canberra shows that 42% of Australians distrust web-only news media, which is even worse than the banks, and 41% print, 28% distrust the TV, and 21% distrust radio. Hurrah for radio! But before we all get excited in radio land, the survey also asked, who or what do you actively trust? And radio came in at 38%, TV at 32%, print at 29%, and web at a lowly 20%. So in the middle of those two numbers, there is a big dollop of people who neither trust or distrust the media, and some of them who don't really care much. And I reckon apathy is a close cousin of distrust. Tonight, we ask, why does the media have a trust problem? And how can we, as individuals and groups, go about fixing it? Is it also a question of media literacy, of helping people understand what is real and what is fake? And is it all the fault of those tech giants like Facebook? And that and many other questions. And to help us through all those questions, we have a wonderful panel, joined in the studio by Andrew Hunter, who is responsible for news partnerships at the aforementioned Facebook. His job is to build bridges between Facebook and media outlets. And interestingly, in another life, Andrew co-wrote an excellent book called All Your Friends Like This, How Social Networks Took Over the News. Good evening, Andrew.
Hi, Peter. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. It's a great pleasure. We also have Sasha Molitoritz, who is a postdoctoral research fellow at the aforementioned Centre for Media Transition and a key author of the report on trust and a longstanding Sydney Morning Herald reporter, blogger, editor, reviewer and features writer. Hello, Sash.
Hey, Peter.
And finally, joining us on the line from the Blue Mountains, we have Saffron Howden, the co-founder of the sadly now defunct Crinkling News, which brought the news to literally thousands of kids across the country until it ran out of money earlier this year. Hola, Saffron.
What an introduction. Hi, Peter.
Was it right? Were you
fact-checking?
Well,
it's true. No longer publishing. Definitely more than thousands of kids.
Shall we say millions?
I think we can very safely say tens of thousands, if not more, yeah.
Okay, well, we'll get to that. We'll get to Crinkling, and it's wonderful what you did and its legacy, I think, in a minute. So let's start off with, how much do you trust the news? Do you get your news from several sources, or do you mainly rely on social media? Do you normally believe the news when you see it on Twitter and Facebook? And more importantly, do you share news with your friends? If so, do you check it first? With the news now available to us wherever, whenever we want it, it would seem that trust in the news has never been more important. So let's start with you, Sasha, and the new Trust in News Media Australia report. What did you find and what surprised you?
Well, first of all, trust is such a great issue to explore. We found that from the start. We spent a few months on this, of course. The first stage was we had a researcher, Elaine McEwen, look into all the academic, non-academic literature and do an annotated bibliography. So that's now published, and it's a great resource for academics, but also for non-academics. And it's there at the Centre for Media Transition website. The second part of what we wanted to do was then really dig into Australians and how they trust news media. And I guess the ultimate question is, how can we restore, or how can they restore trust in news media? the assumption there is that news media is important, that journalism and news is important, that it's vital in a democracy. And we were pleased to find, as we held workshops, the research that we did involved 4 workshops, 2 in Tamworth, mm-hmm. 2 in Sydney, qualitative, hard word to say, workshops, where we had 8 or 9 people talking through these issues. So they weren't large-scale surveys, they were more focused, trying to get opinions and ideas and responses. And so we were seeing what people wanted in their news media, and so how we might rebuild trust. And thankfully, people did share this belief in the importance of news media. It's just that they thought the news media, as it works now, is letting them down.
So did you start off with the idea that that all was wrong in the news media? That we started off on this level, that their trust is a problem.
Well, we started off on the back of the bibliography that with this idea that trust levels have fallen across society for decades now. For the past 50 years or so, there's been this dramatic fall in trust levels in all sorts of institutions. So government, the media as well, banks. This is a whole bunch of institutions people no longer trust. So with news media, in the 70s in the US, the figure was somewhere around more than 2/3 of people trusted news media. By recently, the figure had dropped to about 32%, so less than 1/3. That's a dramatic just drop in the number of people who trust news media.
So what do you think's been going on? Saffron, we'll bring you in here. What do you think's been going on in terms of trust?
Well, look, I think it's a terribly confusing time for everybody, and it's not just the established news media, as you pointed out, but there's a testing of our political systems and parties, of democracy even, of facts, of so many of these established power bases. And I think one of the things that underpins this is a real longing for community and a disconnection from the communities that we used to have. And I think it's interesting to see in your report that quite a lot of people get their news from other people, from work colleagues or at home. And the 2017 media literacy research that Crinkling News did with WSU and QUT found the same thing about kids and young people. And it was these people that they trusted. It was their family and their teachers that they trusted. So we had 23% of 8 to 16-year-olds in Australia trusted news organisations a lot, whereas 58 news from news organisations a lot, whereas 58% trusted news from their family.
So there's a breakdown in the way we get news, and we now have these incredibly wonderful tools, social media tools, that enable us to share news and create friendship groups at random, right?
Well, I think what happened is the news media over the 20th century did get really, really, really big, and it thrived commercially on having the largest possible audience. The bigger the readership, the bigger the viewing or listening public, the bigger the ad dollars. And in the process, journalism became increasingly removed from its audience, from its community. Mm. People now feel underrepresented in the media. They feel disempowered. We're asking them to trust someone they don't know, doing a job they don't really understand, who doesn't really reflect their community. And that's really hard for people.
Yeah, okay. No, that's good. I'd like to bring Andrew in here. You work for Facebook, Andrew. Facebook, among others, gets in the neck for a lot of things, for a host of the world's ills. But let's focus on trust, as we are. How do you see Facebook's role in building these communities and, if you like, repairing this trust question?
I think with Facebook that we see ourselves as very much in the distribution part of the ecosystem, and so it's our responsibility to ensure that the authenticity and the quality of the content that is on Facebook meets our community standards. And so that's the first step mm-hmm. that we need to take. And so, that is something that we do continue to do and continue to focus resources on, is making sure that the content on Facebook is authentic, and that news on Facebook in particular is credible, trustworthy, and informative. And so there's a whole lot of work that we're doing around that. There's been a whole lot of investment that the company has made in both things like artificial intelligence and machine learning, as well as human beings, to review the content on the platform. And then The second...
Just on that point, you can never do enough, right?
Well, it's...
Or can you ever do enough?
No, it is an ongoing program of work that we need to continue to focus a whole lot of resources on. It's what at this stage I would call an ongoing battle.
A work in progress.
Absolutely. It's not something that is going to be solved straight away, and it will require a continued investment.
We're going to come back to Facebook. Is it a problem that people receive their news inside their social when they're getting pictures of their friends at the same time as they're getting the latest news?
Well, look, obviously, I think that I think one of the big shifts in the audience for any kind of information is that, and I don't think this rules out that idea of, you know, potentially people don't want to be friends with, you know, news media organisations, but I don't think people accept being sort of distant, passive consumers anymore. They don't want to be told, and I'm including going beyond the news media with this, and, you know, I'm talking about the sort of general disaffection with major political parties and the political system. They don't want to be told by someone far away from them, this is the way it is. They want to see it and feel it and experience it, and they want to be part of getting back to that community idea where their voices are relevant too. And I think they expect people with the expertise to do their jobs properly, but they're looking for meaning and belonging that news organisations are not giving them. And then social media platforms often give people, I think, a somewhat false sense that they can get a voice and be a part of what's going on. And platforms like Facebook are now grappling with how that system can be manipulated to elevate dangerous or unscrupulous voices in some cases.
Well, that's true. I mean, you said something there which really did touch on the initial question, which is, where did the news media go wrong?
Look, I think it was partly a commercial thing that people realised was, you know, didn't realise was happening while it was happening. And it's the sort of, you know, the rivers of gold time dating back to that in the 70s and 80s and 90s, yeah. You know, where advertising was flourishing and you got more advertising dollar, the more people you could reach. The publishers and broadcasters owned the platforms, and so no one else could compete with that. And then it removed all the media organisations and the journalists into their offices and away from their communities. Mm. And journalists hung out with other journalists. Some journalists became celebrities. People, I remember when I studied journalism at UTS, I was surrounded by students who wanted to get into journalism because they ultimately wanted to be famous.
Really?
And journalism, yes.
Yeah, it really worked for all of us, really, didn't it?
Well, you've got your own podcast now, Peter.
So. Well, I'm famous, that's right. Famous in my own lunchbox. Yeah, keep going.
But I think one of the lessons that I certainly learned through Crinkling News, and I've worked as a journalist for almost 20 years before I started Crinkling News, a newspaper for young people, is that it was about creating a vibrant, safe, national community of kids to give them factual information and a safe place to explore those ideas, current affairs, and quality journalism. Now, the journalism itself was authoritative. It was written by professional journalists, and it was fact-checked, it was sub-edited, it abided by all the normal ethics of traditional journalism. But it was also a community. We also had a website, news videos, social media accounts, emails, letters and events. We had an op-ed section written by kids. We had junior editor and junior reporter programs, news literacy workshops in schools and writers' festivals.
Okay, so yeah, your point being is that you created community with this content, with this news content. And then you were able to, so the people were able to trust you, right? Your audiences really trusted you.
We did have an extraordinarily high level of trust. From our readers, kids, from the people buying the subscriptions and helping the kids use the content, from teachers, from parents, from grandparents, very unusually for a modern media organisation.
Very unusual.
A small one at that.
Okay, all right. We're going to move on to another finding in the report, which is around the need of news consumers or desire to have their news media to be more transparent. I'm going to start with you again, Sash. What is this all about, this transparency like? I mean, what's you know, aren't we transparent?
Yeah.
Well, or not?
I think I'll answer that by responding to Saffron there too. I think she hit the nail on the head there with What they did with Crinkling, of course, it was a great success with its audience. And I think what is becoming more obvious is it is all about the relationship, and trust is part of that. So we just, that connection between journalists and readers, that relationship is absolutely the key. So social media and search engines and digital platforms play a really important role, but the challenge, as we've talked about, is how do news producers monetize their content. Now what we found in the report, as you say, in part was that people really wanted transparency. They wanted a degree of okay, how did this story come about? Who did you interview? Why didn't you cover this story? So it's some sort of transparency about the whole news making and gathering process. Ooh. And that was one of the ingredients. So what we found from people generally was they wanted a whole bunch of traditional journalistic ingredients, you know, stuff you traditionally think of when you think of journalist values, like accuracy, objectivity, in the public interest. But they also wanted some other, and transparency is there too, but they wanted some others as well that were a bit more changeable and a bit new, like interactivity, diversity, and a few other factors like that. Then at the other extreme, the things they didn't want were be like a friend and be less voice of God was another option we gave them. So they wanted a mix of things, mostly traditional journalistic values, but a few other characteristics that were a bit more what people are now used to in a social media age.
Okay, Andrew, that's a tricky word, transparency, right? I mean, it means a lot of things to a lot of people.
Yeah.
It means different things to journalists. I'm sure it means different things to Facebook. Transparency has been a hot word for you guys this year. How do you look at transparency? I mean, people say to Facebook all the time, hey, be more transparent and tell us what's in your black box. Clearly, that ain't going to happen. But be more transparent and tell us when you're going to make changes to the algorithm. Maybe that might happen. How do you manage expectations about transparency?
Well, I think before I answer that, I think that the need and the desire for transparency on the part of consumers is really, really interesting. And I think there are a lot of news organizations who are responding to that in really great ways, where
you got some examples?
Well, I think it's particularly a trend in the US where you will see a whole lot of disclaimers and disclosures at the bottom of the story saying how the story has changed over the past couple of hours as the author or the journalist has got more information. And I think that's obviously a great start. I think there are a number of news organisations who provide a lot of information about their journalists, talk about what they have done, what they've studied, what are the stories that they've pursued and written before, which I think is all really helpful for context as well. And that's kind of the way we think about it as well. And so one of the things that I announced today at the Mumbrella Publish conference that I was at was that we were going to be launching a context button around news posts on Facebook, which show information to the Facebook user about to give them information as to the credibility of the piece of content itself and the source of that story. And so there are a few things that we've done there. One is we've added the information about the publisher. Mm-hmm. We've added related articles around that story as well so that people can see other takes on the same topic, as well as information showing or graphics showing who in your network has shared that story and where people geographically around Australia in this case have shared the story.
And
as
is
well.
That up and running now?
I haven't actually. It is.
It is up and running.
It is up and running
well,
now,
well
and
done.
So
that's great.
We're doing that in New Zealand as well.
We don't care about them. So,
well, I do.
Well, it's nice that you care about them.
Deeply.
It's good that someone in this room cares about the New Zealand.
I love New Zealand.
Oh, here we go. Apparently, it's a Kiwi fest. All right, go on.
And I think that's an example of how Facebook, as part of the distribution part of the ecosystem, can give credibility indicators to the people on Facebook, and to an extent help with media literacy, and do a small bit there right on the spot to educate the user about that piece of content.
Yeah, and it's a great. How do you see? How would that work? You go on a piece, and there's a button that says if you want to know more, you want some context.
Yes. So there is like an information button. There are related links. Mm-hmm. That's basically the way it works. It's a little discrete component around a post in Facebook newsfeed. And I think, you know, that's educating on the spot. I think what Saffron's done with Crinkling News is fantastic because you're educating the next generation of news consumers. And there's a ton of supply of news right now and a continually massive supply of news. And so I think working on the demand side of that equation and making sure that we have really well-educated consumers coming down the pipeline from the schools is a great thing. And I had it with Behind the News, and I'm glad that at least for a little while there were some kids that had it with Crinkling News.
And they may
as
have it again. You never know. You know, someone might have been listening to this podcast, this radio show. They might turn up on your doorstep tomorrow with a very large check. So
yeah. Well, I hope something like that. You know,
comes again.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, for my kids' sake too.
Yeah, okay. So you didn't answer the question about Facebook's own transparency. Maybe that's going to be another show.
Although, I told you about the context.
No, that's true.
Feature that we added.
That's true. That's a wonderful thing. We always want more. I mean, isn't it a funny thing that we always want more from Facebook?
Can I jump in though, because you touched obviously on media literacy, and I think, you know, it's kind of a term that's been bandied around a lot at the moment and people aren't necessarily engaged with what it is. I think one of the really, really sort of leveling, democratizing things about media literacy is it puts the power into the individual's hands. It doesn't tell you to read one news site or watch one TV show over another. It doesn't tell you to stay away from social media. It doesn't tell you to think Steve Bannon is evil or Sky News After Dark is a hotbed of common sense. It simply tells you to think about the information you consume.
So it's neither the ABC or the Australian.
it encourages you to think about where it comes from, how it was produced, and why it was produced.
I totally agree. And, I couldn't agree more. And I think that's what's come through in your report as well.
Like absolutely.
The people in Sydney and Tamworth have recommended that, you know, they go behind the story, that publications clearly label the story as well, which is a transparency thing. Is it opinion? Is it fact? I couldn't agree more. It's all about critical thinking.
Just in defence of journalism here, that is literally what journalists have been doing
for a long, long, long time. But yeah,
really long time.
I know. We lost that message somewhere. But that's another whole new show. Let me just get back to Sasha, and then we're going to go to our final, slightly more contentious item because we're all agreeing at too much in this show, far too much. One of the questions that always comes to mind in terms of media literacy is a bit like eating your veggies, really, isn't it? Mm. You know, you should do it, but not everyone does it, right? I mean, everyone says, yeah,
absolutely,
of course, you should read multiple versions of the story to get, you know, somewhere near the truth. Mm. And yet, really, not many people do that. So what ideas do we have, you know, that may come out of this report, or, you know, it's open to everyone on the panel, do we have for actually making media literacy not like eating broccoli?
Well, I don't think it has to be like. I don't mind broccoli, to be honest.
Yeah, I knew you.
Look,
I had to.
But no.
How about kale?
In all seriousness, you're right. You know, you can't ram media literacy down people's throats beyond a certain point. I do think it's really important for kids. You know, so kids.
But so is getting good night's sleep. They don't do that either.
True. This is a wildly changing environment, this media environment. I don't think there's ever been anything like this in history. The way that, you know, in media terms, there can't have been. You know, the digital disruption that's going on is just unprecedented, and so it's a really difficult time to work out how am I going to be a news consumer. You know, this is hard as an adult. You know, someone. You know, I worked as a journalist at the Sydney Morning Herald as well, and I'm a pretty savvy consumer of the news. And this is a confusing time for me, let alone for kids. So I think it's important.
How do we answer this question?
Exactly. So what we need to get to when we do teach is some general principles almost and some general practices mm-hmm. that aren't specific. So, you know, you need to address the big topics like privacy and you know, what should you share and is it okay to share? A lot of these questions are ethical questions, yeah, really, absolutely. Ultimately. So they tie in, those media literacy questions tie in. So I think you're right. It is a bit like broccoli, and we can't overdo it. But there's a certain amount that's necessary.
So, we can't actually put it in the school curriculum.
Well, I'd just sort of jump in on that one, Saffron, because as you know, I've spoken to some very senior members of the education authorities across the country, and not only in this one, in the state. But and the point that is often made is teachers, they're up to their armpits, eyeballs in the curriculum already. And as much as we'd love to do some more on media literacy, you know, they're going to blow up if they have to teach this. So how do the kids, and not just the kids, by the way, the adults too, I'm going to ask you and then I'm going to throw it to Andrew. I know one answer was curriculum news. What's the next one?
Look, I think media literacy is, it's a long game. There's no doubt about that. I think in the meantime, I think the work that Facebook's doing, we haven't mentioned Google. It's obviously things like YouTube, particularly for younger audiences, having a huge impact on people. I think your report also mentions that, you know, people don't necessarily get their news from a news source. They might get it from a comedy news show, and that's their only source of news for the week, you know. I think that in the meantime, people need to think critically. They need to be encouraged to do that. I think journalists need to be very open about what they do, and I think with journalists already have a platform. I think, you know, we should be bringing people along for the ride. We should be explaining to people what we're doing and why we're doing it, and we should be using the platforms that we have, because I think, you know, the other thing that we haven't done yet is we haven't shown people why journalism even matters. I think people take news for granted. It's obviously every person is naturally curious normally about what's, you know, going on around them and in their community. But the implications good journalism has for a thriving democracy are huge.
Yep, okay. I hear that. And I would say that is the subject of a forthcoming show, because I believe there will be a campaign soon on that very subject, reminding people that journalism does bloody matter. Andrew, just a final point from you on this, because I do want to have a couple of minutes to throw this rather contentious story out at the end.
Okay. I think that you if you want to sell it to the Department of Education, I think you probably take it a level higher and say, this is about critical thinking. This is about psychology. Let's talk to our kids about psychology and a little bit of philosophy as well. Mm-hmm. And I think if you look at Daniel Kahneman, the psychologist economist who talks about biases, I think that's a really fun way that you can get into this subject, and you can play all sorts of interesting exercises and tricks with kids to show where they might have biases and where they might not have biases.
Great idea. Do you think we should just leave the studio and do an MVP on that? I think we should build it. Let's build it. Come on, let's not muck around. Let's not just talk about it. Let's just do it.
Let's do it. Okay.
Okay. All right.
I've got half an hour this.
Yeah, you won't need half an hour the way you spoke about that. On a more serious note, I think thank you all for being a wonderful panel. This is it from the Fourth Estate tonight. I would like to thank my guests, Andrew Hunter from Facebook. Thank you, Andrew.
Thanks, Peter.
Sasha Molitores from the Center for Media Transition. Thank you, Sash.
Thanks, Peter.
And on the line from the Blue Mountains, the co-founder of Crinkling News, bring it back, Saffron Howden. Thank you for being on the show.
Thanks, Peter.
Make sure you subscribe to The Fourth Estate on your favorite podcast app so you can hear us talk media, politics, and a few things in between at your leisure. And we'll be back with more next week. But in the meantime, you can stay in touch with us, of course, on Facebook and Twitter, and where our handle is Fourth Estate AU. And my name is Peter Frey. Thank you for listening. Thank you to my producer. And always think of it this way. There's always a journalist who you can trust. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.